Okay, so, this is exactly what I outlined, but this is part of the, we're going to look at this. I'm actually going to start with a little bit of introduction for the non-astrophysical terminal people, an introduction on fast events and reconnection with solar program. Then I'm going to talk about my work on interacting vortex tubes, going back to 1983 maybe. Then a little bit about the traditional theory of magnetic reconnection. I'm not going to talk about this. And then Kathy will take over down here, just talk more about the magnetic stuff we've been working on. So, start off with what happens in the solar corona. Anyone who's ever been associated with AGO has seen this picture 1,000 times, and therefore I must apologize. This is taken with the Mauna Loa coronagraph in Hawaii. The disk of the sun is this dotted line here, and there's an occulting disk. There's an occulting disk, which gives you an artificial eclipse. So you can see the outer part of the corona at all times of the year. You don't have to wait every few years for a nice eclipse. And the sequence of events here is that there's these things called helmet streamers, where you have an arcade of magnetic field lines. So there's magnetic field lines like this that are looping around the sun in sort of a two-dimensional pattern. And they hold aloft a certain amount of plasma, hot plasma, which is what you're looking at here. And that situation just sort of persists for weeks and weeks and weeks. And then in the order of an hour or two, a few hours, these will blow off and then reform. And the events that blow off are called coronal mass ejections. These are things that happen in the corona. That's why it's coronal, and it's ejecting a lot of mass. So what you're seeing here is this actually started down at the solar surface here, and now you're seeing it coming out behind the occulting disk, and you're seeing this mass of material that was held down by the magnetic field escaping out into interplanetary space. After it has started to escape from the sun, there's a flare which started down here somewhere. Now you're seeing it coming up outside of the occulting disk. And that flare, in combination with the coronal mass ejection, sending particles out to interplanetary space, is what is primarily responsible for solar storms that hit the Earth and disrupt the communications, fry communication satellites, and the more satellites we're putting up there for communications, the more relevant this is for everyday life. Now, the basic theory behind a coronal mass ejection is that you have this arcade. This is continued off in the third dimension to some degree. You have an arcade of magnetic field lines that's holding down this plasma, and then it ejects this plasmoid up here, and then there's inflow into the region here where the magnetic field lines have been stretched out. Those magnetic field lines are pushed together and they reconnect, and that begins what we think is the flaring. Now, as I said, the time scale for...
So the flaring begins after the reconnect.
It begins after the coronal mass ejection takes off. The flaring is probably associated with reconnection, but there's no reconnection until this thing, through some sort of gravitational instability, has taken off.
The inner lines of this plasmoid are already reconnected, right? So it's a successive stage of the reconnection.
Well, this is the stage in which it is... This is the way it was at the beginning. Okay, and then what has happened with time is as follows.
What kept it for a few weeks?
These are questions that aren't really well known. So you have the solar surface, you have this thing down here, and so this first forms like this, so there's no reconnection. And then you go to a later stage where it looks like this.
No, the inner contours you have drawn, they have reconnected, right?
No, no, they have stayed the way they are. That's the way, they started out like this. Okay, and this outer one has been pulled out.
At the tip, you have other contours, right? Those have reconnected.
They actually haven't. There's been,
keep drawing.
There's no.
Next one, the next one, they have reconnected.
And here they have reconnected, yes. And here they have reconnected.
He's just drawing the next contour.
Possibly he's saying the weaker field lines have reconnected.
That is not the picture that, I'm not quite explaining this right. I'm trying to give a very basic picture of a two-dimensional flow that is actually three-dimensional. It's far more complicated than this.
I get quite making there a succession of reconnection, right?
Yeah.
I've seen
no, way. But there's really nothing until these two. The original profile is more like this. There's magnetic open, what are called open magnetic field lines. This is how it starts off more. Like this. Okay, that's where it starts off. And then these just bunch up a little bit and then take off.
Hung up on this.
Let's not worry about this.
Yeah,
this
from
not
the second to third figure.
I don't want to discuss this anymore.
So
this is motivation. Motivation. The point is, my next slide is that when this happens, when you get the significant inflow and you get a significant amount of reconnection in there, that's associated with when this coronal mass ejection picks off. That's what this is indicating here. Now, if you look at the soft X-ray images, that or white light, that takes a few hours or a few minutes to build up to its peak, and it lasts for several hours. But there's an addition, and that's fast compared to the several week period where the thing just sat there. But there's an even faster event where the hard X-rays suddenly increase enormously on the time scale of milliseconds. And that's associated with electrons that have been emitted from the reconnection region. So suddenly the reconnection just turns on almost instantaneously. And that's where you start thinking, well, could there be some sort of singularity or something like that? Now, traditional theory of reconnection, going back to Parker Sweet about 40 years ago, 1959, 1962, if you take two...
Could I just be a devil's advocate on this interpretation of the acceleration of fast particles?
Yeah.
What we know is there's a sudden surge in the energetic particles and their emission. Now, one could see that either by very rapid acceleration, or you might say that they're always being or more gradually accelerated, but there's sufficient change in the topology during the reconnection process that they get out. Okay.
That's fine, too. Okay, so a sudden change in topology, that's fine with me, too. There's a sudden change in something.
Yeah, this is sure.
Well, it's there. Let's try and understand where it's coming from. Okay, the traditional picture, the two-dimensional picture, the X-point picture, is that you have magnetic field lines going like this on one side of a dividing line and magnetic field lines on the other side going like this. And there might be some small inflow that goes in and pushes these together, but by and large, this is diffusive reconnection. It's resistive reconnection. It will take place on a time scale that's based on the magnetic resistivity. It'll take forever.
And this is two-dimensional.
Two-dimensional. Now, you can improve upon this enormously if you feed energy into the system that you have a significant inflow, and then you get what are called slow NHD shocks here, and most of the dissipation, most of the reconnection can occur along the slow NHD shocks. And this could, in principle, speed up the reconnection rate to be fast enough to be consistent with at least the rise in the soft X-rays that I just showed you. The problem with this is, as far as the corona is concerned, is to keep this inflow going, you have to have a source, and the corona is extremely diffuse,
and there's no material out there basically to keep feeding in and resist the pressure that's building up in here. Furthermore, these are static calculations. They're 2D static calculations. If you actually run this dynamically, what you get are sheets of current, and these current sheets suppress all nonlinearities and suppress any tendency towards any sort of fast events going on.
And then, so do you probably can prove that there are no finite time singularities?
It's not quite so obvious in 2D MHC because
there is... 2D MHC, I mean, yeah.
Yeah, but a number of people have made a lot of progress, and for every reason, we have every reason to believe there probably is. It's not like 2D Euler where it's back in the envelope. Okay, now, that's MHD in reconnection in 5 minutes. Here is a picture that Fosley will like, taken from a paper of his on vortex reconnection. So instead of magnetic field lines, now we have vortex lines. And you start with two anti-parallel vortex lines in three-dimensional space. If it was purely two-dimensional, they'd just propagate on forever and ever if it's Euler, that is, if there's no viscosity. What happens first is that through the three-dimensional Biot-Savart interaction, the vortex lines are put together by their mutual induction. They reconnect, and then you get separation. Now, this is seen. This is called the Crow instability. This is out of Crow's 1970 paper. And so you have, what you have here is two contrails off the wingtips of a plane. So they're anti-parallel vortices that come off the wingtips. You can see them often because the vortex cores have lower pressure, so there's condensation in the vortex cores, and therefore the condensation is what you're seeing. So you're seeing the vortex cores, and in a fairly short amount of time, 30 seconds, 45 seconds, you see that they have come together, and they reconnect in one place, and then they reconnect in several places. Now, so that's the vortex reconnection problem. Now, I'm going to now discuss an issue about singularities of the Euler equations. Now, I'm going to explain in 1 second what I mean by singularity, but in this sequence of events, when I'm talking about singularity, I'm talking about the dynamics that takes us from this point to this point, to the point where they're just touching. That's all what we're talking about when we're talking about singularities of Euler. All the rest of this is Navier-Stokes. That means there's viscosity in the problem. So, the equations we used for studying whether there's singularities of the Euler equations are the Euler equations in their vorticity form. So you have a time derivative vorticity, advection of vorticity, and the important term is the vortex stretching term, which for all you MHD people is very similar to the magnetic field line stretching term. And I'll get to that, those analogies in a second. And if you add viscosity, you'll get Navier-Stokes. What type of singularity were we talking about? We're talking about one that's starting with smooth initial conditions, and it does not involve any input of energy. It has finite energy to begin with, and that's where the energy stays. So, here's a diagram of what we're talking about. You have two field lines, your vortex lines, oppositely directed, separated by a distance delta. If viscosity is not equal to zero, if you're having reconnection, then, as I just showed you, there's annihilation of the original vortex lines and reconnections to get two new vortex lines to separate. The singularity question is, if the viscosity is zero, is there some conditions under which delta can go to zero? That is there some strain, E, that can push the vortex lines together so they'll touch and start to reconnect, even when viscosity is going to zero? So another way of phrasing these is, besides delta going to zero, is it's equivalent to saying the strain goes to infinity in a finite time. And to see why the strain has to go to infinity and exactly what the condition is, adding to mathematical nomenclature here. here, the infinity is the maximum over all components of the stress. So it's a peak value over all space of a derivative of the velocity, somewhere. And so this d delta dt is going to go as minus that derivative is some delta, maybe. And if that's the case, then integrating out delta, that's going to be an exponential of integral from 0 to some times t of this derivative of the velocity dt. If you want delta to go to 0, that can only happen if the integral inside there goes to infinity, and that happens only if du or e goes to infinity or t goes to infinity. So you can either have the strain or stress go to infinity, or you can have time go to infinity. Furthermore, it's a time integral singularity. It depends on the integral here. So that says additional things about how this should go to infinity. That's a crude description of it. The precise mathematical statement is found in a paper by Bielkate and Maida in 1984, which states that the peak value or the sup of omega integral from 0 to t. So the important thing is, we're not talking about just any component of the stress or the strain now. We're talking about the vorticity, that particular part of the velocity derivative called the vorticity. The integral from 0 to t of omega infinity dt goes to infinity. And it implies a number of things that are useful for doing numerics. It says that if you're looking for singularities, you only have to look at the vorticity. You don't have to look at the fourth derivative or the fifth derivative velocity. No hidden singularities in higher derivatives. Furthermore, if it's algebraic, if the peak value of the vorticity, L infinity norm goes as 1 over some critical time, singular time minus t to some power gamma, then gamma must be greater than or equal to 1. If someone comes to me and says, I have a calculation where I got this, but gamma is 0.8, they've done something wrong. In fact, people did do this mistake before 1984. And then on dimensional grounds, we expect gamma to be equivalent to 1. So, with that basis, I did a number of tests of numerical calculations of this sort, starting with this initial condition, driving it to that point there, and plotted 1 over the peak vorticity, the L infinity norm. That should be linear. It should go to 0 at some critical time, which I estimate to be 18.7. This is reasonably linear, and you can see all the plots and mesh resolution comparisons and everything else, my 1993 paper on this. And there's also another test that you can do on the L infinity norm of the strain that's pulling out the vorticity. And then there's actually a an integral over space of the vortex stretching terms that will also have this linear in time behavior, 1 over that. So I have 3 independent tests that give me a measure that this could be going to a singularity. Now this is what I got in 1993. Just to give you an idea of the history of this, before I published my paper in 93, there was a periodic oscillation in people's belief of whether there could or could not be a singularity of the Euler equation. 1980, time series analysis using Petty approximants said yes, there was, and then in a calculation that's very similar in symmetries to what we're about to present for MHD, something called the Taylor-Green vortex, they showed that the time series analysis was wrong. They concluded that there were no singularities, and the reason was the formation of vortex sheets. Okay, so for the MHD people, think about vortex sheets as sort of some analogy to current sheets. Then people started thinking about vortex filaments. They said yes. And then a paper by me and Alan Fumir did a calculation that said the initial stuff of that was wrong, that there probably were no singularities. Then somewhere in the middle, here was this paper by Bielkate and Maida that actually told us what to look for the first time, in the middle of all this. And eventually I came up with my conclusion in 1993 that there probably could be a singularity of oil.
And what happened subsequently?
No one followed.
It has oscillated a little bit here and there, but
the jury is still out.
There are still outstanding questions, but the problem is at this point the numerics have gotten to the point of such enormous, I mean, I was doing 256 squared by 512 cubed numerics in 1993, which was an enormous thing and took an enormous amount of effort. And that still is a large calculation. And really, to beat this, somebody's got to do 2,000 cubed mesh points and have a really, really good adaptive mesh refinement calculation. It's not a trivial matter to do the next step. I mean, I've been talking with John Gibbon and Fosley and Norman Zabuski and other people around here. I mean, I've been talking to you guys for almost 15 years about this now, but I've been talking about them with
really, you can't say yes. You say yes, maybe.
Yeah. We'll always say yes.
Maybe. No finite difference calculation can allow you to say yes.
That's right. But the thing that might do, it might inspire you to look at them.
To be fair, Norman, he said qualified probably in words, right?
Yes,
he did.
I didn't hear him say that. I just
sort of once you do the analog of what a critical phenomenon person would call finite size scaling, I mean, when we are rich enough to do that, you can't say yes.
Right, and the problem is that we don't have a calculation now that allows us to do that.
I agree.
Well, okay, now, MHD. Now we're going to add in the Lorentz force and a whole new set of equations for the magnetic field. So we have time derivative of B, advection of B, stretching of B, corresponding in the vorticity to time derivative of vorticity, advection of vorticity, stretching of vorticity. But the right analogy between MHD and hydro is not vorticity magnetic field, it is actually vorticity current. And if you rewrite the magnetic MHD equations,
when current is a normal vector, vorticity is a pseudo vector.
We're talking about in terms of the energy is contained in the velocity or the magnetic field, and therefore the quantity that we want to think about in terms of possibly going singular for MHD isn't the magnetic field, it's going to be the current. That's the analogy. So here's the equation for current. Current is the curl of B, and it's a big mess. But another thing you can do is you can take, rewrite the MHD equations in terms of L-faster variables, Z plus or minus equals U plus or minus B. And then you write that like this, and this is sort of some sort of pressure, the pressure plus 1/2 B squared, and this looks identical to the Euler equations, except it's got these funny pluses and minuses there. And the result of that is that you go somewhere in this pile is the view graph that says this, but you go through all the same mathematics, you go through all the same scaling arguments I just told you about, and if you're going to have a singularity of ideal, incompressible, three-dimensional MHD, what you expect is 1 over the peak current plus 1 over the peak vorticity. They have to be together because the analysis is based on Z, which is a combination of velocity and magnetic field. That should go as Tc minus T. That is, you plot this versus time, this quantity here.
But here it's not a serial. So it's here it's an educated guess.
Yes, there is. There's an equivalent result to the BKM. Catfish, cat, from steel.
Right.
Which, it's the same theorem. You replace omega infinity by J infinity plus omega infinity.
So it's a
proven rate. We've done it about 2 years, 2-3 years ago. But the methods are entirely identical.
So it's like BKM just in general.
Yeah, so it's a revamp of BKM with a few more terms.
Okay. That's the official theorem. And then this other piece is my inference. And so if you're going to have a singularity and you plot this, this should be going and looking like that. That's what it should do. Okay.
Now, at some point here, Axel's going to tell me that it's time for me to step down and for him to take over. You want to show this? We start with. Oh no! I did bring the wires in. They're in my office. You want me to run down and get them?
No, I got them.
You'll get them.
Okay. I don't have the key.
Is the office open? Is it, you know where they are. They're right in front of the terminal.
Let me show them.
Thank you. Anyway, we start with, instead of anti-parallel, what we started with was two late magnetic flux rings, like this. And this is how they evolve in time. And I think I'll wait for Misha. Or do you want to just show a video while
we're waiting? Let's explain this one first, and then we
okay.
Turn it
on. What happens initially is due to the Lorentz force, due to the fact that, I mean, this isn't the way B.C. Lowe would like to describe it, but this is the way I'm describing it right now. If you take a single magnetic flux ring, the magnetic tension around it will tend to want to make it shrink. His argument is more areas of pressures, but in any case, the flux ring will shrink. If we have two linked magnetic flux rings like this, what they'll do is they'll shrink into each other. Now, as they're shrinking, what happens is they create, through the Lorentz force, a velocity field that's characterized by two. Go. Thank you.
Oh, wow.
Okay, so we start off with a configuration that looks like this. And then what happens is it induces vortex fields that look like this. So around each vortex are anti-parallel vortex rings. Around each flux tube, there are anti-parallel vortex rings. And that's what causes this dimple in the middle. And that's what pushes them together. And so you have
Are they trying to go away from each other or going toward
each other? They're going toward each other, okay. In here like this. So here's the magnetic ones, they're going in like this.
Right.
Together.
Right.
Okay?
The anti-parallel?
The rings of vorticity, white and yellow, are anti-parallel. So there's an anti-parallel here. They collide into each other in a quadrupole of vortices. And that tends to create a current sheet in the middle. But that's our current understanding. What happened is, the history of this was, Axel and me decided to simulate this because we were at a meeting on MHD Helicity in Boulder, and everyone was talking about this situation as a paradigm for understanding magnetic helicity in the solar corona, and saying all sorts of theoretical things based on how this should behave. And we asked the innocent question, has anyone actually simulated this to see if it actually does any of the things that people claimed it did. And that was the reason for doing it. And this was our initial series of pictures that we produced, that Axel produced. And what we saw is in a very short time, and this is basically an Alphase time based on the peak value of the initial magnetic field, within 3 or 4 Alphane times, we were getting what looked like significant amounts of magnetic reconnection. And the only 3D calculations that had been done previously that weren't forced to have magnetic reconnection had taken the order of 100 Alphane times.
Could I ask a clarification?
Yeah.
From 1 to 2, you say in 2 each vortex ring pair have opposite magnetic lines, so the flux of the initial one. Okay, I don't
know. This is vortex lines. These are vortex lines. So it produces around each magnetic flux tube.
Two vortices.
Yeah.
What happens to the magnetic lines? They're all in the, still the same direction.
They're all in the same direction, yes.
Bob?
Yeah.
It looks like the two anti-parallel rings are trying to get away from each other by...
On the outside they are, but in here they've collapsed. See, there was a gap here initially, and they've been pushed into each other.
No, I was talking about the two look, from 2 to 3, it looks like...
It started to reconnect.
Oh.
Okay.
What kind of magnetic resonance
numbers were giving you the fast reconnection?
I'll show you in a second. That's the next picture. Okay. So, we were seeing this fast reconnection, and I knew of this new math at that point, you know, a few months old mathematical result of Kaplis, Clapper, and Steele on the current. So I suggested to Axel that why don't we plot 1 over that quantity? And the dotted line was his first crude calculation. And here's the resistivity. So it's 0.002. You're trying to figure out a magnetic Reynolds number out of that. It's probably around 1,000 or something like that. And then the subsequent calculations were, in principle, ideal, but they have numerical resistivity that kicks in at some point here. And the point was that you go from 128 cubed to 256 cubed, and you're getting convergence onto a line that looks like it's linear. And so we got very encouraged about this result. And then at the same time Axel did this, I started incompressible calculations, which we'll get to at the end, after Axel goes through his videos and things like that. We felt we had enough evidence to publish in PRL that there was some evidence for some sort of singularity of the type that we were talking about here. Now, that's what we thought at the time. Should I show this picture now, or should we deal with that later?
Maybe point out at this on this plot the two different resolutions, 556 cubed and 128 cubed.
128, 256.
The main difference is that in the 256 cube case, the current increases by a factor of 2, as you would expect, because right, you have finer meshes.
Right.
Otherwise, it stays equally similar.
The controversy that has come up concerning this is this really algebraic singular behavior of the type that I said we might be looking for? Or is this actually just exponential growth? And we don't have enough time span, and we're just misinterpreting our results. So, what we have here is two comparisons, one the algebraic one, and one an exponential down here. So this is a linear log plot. And what we see here is a very long regime where different calculations are giving growth that looks relatively exponential. And then maybe over the last bit, it could be turning out to be more algebraic. But, you know, this is a very complicated issue, which we'll keep talking on as long as people want to talk on. But I think the point is that this issue is not proven. Either there is a singularity or it's not a singularity. We don't have enough resolution, and this is not the right configuration for doing more. But it's time for Axel to take over and show his stuff.
So that is that. Was that incompressible, your simulations?
His calculations are all weakly compressible. Mine are all totally incompressible, but he's actually done some reasonable low beta compressible calculations too. But that stuff we've never talked about in detail. I think they probably want you to get wired up here.
It's good. Another question. I may have misunderstood something. If the thing is not linear, if it's a higher, an exponential would also be like a higher power.
Right.
Isn't that still consistent with this?
If you look at the exponential, then eventually it's going to, if you try to interpret it, it won't fit in that integral formula up there. That's the formula you really need to follow. And the thing that I should say, though, is that for explaining the solar physics problem, we don't need an actual singularity. We need something really fast. So even if we don't say, hey, this is definitely a singularity, if we can identify some really fast dynamics, that's not the solar physics problem.
So you just need violent growth.
We just need violent growth, right.
So what are your simulations?
So this is not a compressor calculation at a Mach number, at the maximum Mach number of one. And the so initially we start off with this interlocked flux ring, pair of flux rings. They do have helicity, which you can verify. The helicity, that is the integral of A dot B, is equal to twice the product of the two fluxes, which are in the two cases equal. So it's the result for the helicity, therefore 2 times phi squared by phi flux. Now, this quantity is conserved in the ideal case, and in the resistive case, and this is a resistive case, the quantity is still almost perfectly conserved up to three digits. Now, here we see the resistive calculation first, because that can be carried out beyond the time where the current reaches its peak, and that is a time of around 2.5 in this calculation. So here you see how the flux rings shrink. They become smaller because of the curvature force. The ring tries to reduce its radius. Now this goes backwards. And then you see this time when the inner part of the ring shrinks faster than the outer part. And that happens all the time. And the reason for that is that we use a profile that is peaked in the middle. It's something like it's close to a Gaussian profile for the cross-sectional field strength.
So would it be uniform or would it still be the same?
Probably not. Because then...
uniform disturbed boundary inside the...
Then at least at first, the Lorentz force on all points would be the same.
But they still try to escape each other.
Yeah, they still try to reduce, of course, the range.
Most likely the same evolution. So in this sense, it's much an independent
profile. We haven't really checked this. But at least... The question is whether or not the indentation will always happen, or whether it is it can be reduced by using a box-like cross-section. The idea of this box-like cross-section, of course, would be that the curvature...
So once you have magnetic lines that are curved, they're going to want to pull in.
Yes, but the stronger the field, the faster they will shrink. And the ring is the strongest, the field is the strongest in the center of the ring, of course. Now, as time goes on, the two rings come eventually into contact, and this is approximately the time where the current reached its peak.
About 2.5 to 3.
There's no sign, actually, of a tilt, really. Although we were expecting that, but there's no sign of these rings either becoming locally parallel or anti-parallel.
Right.
Now let's go to the next animation. That's one of Bob Kerr's highest resolution data at a resolution of 648 cubed, and that is and he shows the current together with the the current isosurface, as you see here.
So this is in the innermost region. Let me.
Yes. I'll stop this.
I just made this up in the movie this morning. So, if you take this picture here and take these two times, 2 and 3. 2 is just before reconnection starts, 3 is just after. And what you see is you get 1 or 2 overlapping current sheets right in this.
That's current you're looking at there?
Hmm?
That's current?
That's current. Current is the gradient on the outside of this. Okay. And we're just looking at this innermost region right in here. Okay. Now, when I went incompressible, and there's a slight change to the initial conditions and really high resolution, this is the picture of the current sheet right in the middle there. And the theory is generally, is if there's a current sheet, this should suppress singularities. And there is evidence that that is happening. But also, there is some extra structure out in the wings here, where the magnetic field lines and the vortex lines have aligned themselves into orthogonal situations and are interacting in a somewhat different way. The peak current here is out here, and out here is not right in the center. And so now going back to the picture, this is to give you a picture of this in full three dimensions as it's rotating around.
Initially, the vortex, the magnetic lines are not moving around, but as soon as you have the vortex, they will be, so they can actually be away from
the saddle.
Right.
It's going
to be up.
Yeah, right there, yes. Well, it's where the curvature of the sheet will be greatest.
That's right. It's where the curvature
is very strong curvature on this sheet, and that's where you've got trouble.
That's where the interesting stuff is.
That's happening. What you would expect.
Right.
Yeah, so it's not in the center.
So it's not in the center. Yeah. But you always start to get it out in these regions here when you start getting beyond the point where initially, because of this effect, the two rings smashing themselves together in this region in here, the initial effect is that there's this enormous thinning of the current sheet right there. You have a lot of trouble resolving that. And then, if you can keep that resolved, then interesting stuff starts happening in these outer regions. Now, what that interesting stuff is, we don't know yet.
Do you ever encounter instabilities in the current sheet? Do you think that for the simple sheets, there are very well-defined tearing mode stability limits
right.
that would regulate to what extent these things are slowing down the reconnection. That can be partly very strongly influenced by geometry.
And so long as it remains in sort of a parallel situation where tearing mode type approximations are valid, that sort of thing can happen. So the question is there a region where there's strong curvature in three dimensions of the current sheet where those approximations aren't valid anymore? And so what we're getting to the point now in our calculations, I mean our initial calculations, we were a little bit too enthusiastic about the singularity business, but in reality almost everything was happening down here. But now that we're getting up to higher resolution and we're seeing that this looks horribly under-resolved. It's got all sorts of wiggles in it. The reason is that I had to take only every fourth point to get it onto the computer system here so that I could do some graphics on it last night. So that's what the wiggles are. I mean, this is the, don't turn it off. This is, you know, the nice picture I made back at home before I came.
So what is the vorticity doing?
Well, what the vorticity is doing is it's aligned itself with the magnetic field in these corners here. But it's orthogonal with its pair on the other side, in this very local region in here.
Well, don't you have just four reconnecting vortex regions, essentially?
Well, yes, but there's an additional component of current in between them.
Just forget about the current for a moment.
Right.
There are four vortex regions that are reconnected.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And those are the region of the highest curvature, double curvature, sort of like a saddle
right.
curvature.
Right.
That's the essence of it.
That could be the essence.
Yeah, those solar force.
But
then you have to put back the force to change that essence.
Right.
But think of it as a perturbation. You have two
from your point, right.
Yeah.
That's the place I started to think about it. But the MHC people here might think
that
about it.
That would be a very interesting point to try to resolve, to see where really. In fact, what are the intensities? You just heard the current sheet. So, how is the intensity of the current sheet localized with respect to the vortex reconnection point?
Those lower those points.
One thing is, first of all, remarkable is that the current is almost uniform across this area, the current that is shown here is within 90 or 80% of the maximum. But in the, you might know this.
Yeah, right.
It's not an isotherm. But I would say that the magnetic Reynolds number is not too high.
No, we're not at high enough Reynolds numbers.
See, in other words, in order to distinguish whether the current sheet is showing any singular or localizations of high current sheet, you have to have a high magnetic Reynolds number.
You're right.
Okay. And if there's sort of an imbalance between the true Reynolds number and the magnetic Reynolds number, then it will tend to make the current sheet look uniform.
Here's a picture. I mean, the local magnetic Reynolds number right in this region here, you know, if you take the length scale there and take the grid size and compare the two, we're not at a very high magnetic Reynolds number for that. Over the whole thing, you might think you're at a high Reynolds number, but locally, what really matters, it isn't that high yet. And this was the point I wanted to, here are two pictures of, here's a slice at a funny plane, here's the funny plane first. So this is a plane through that structure with the current sheet being pulled out. So it's just one little line of the current sheet. And then what I've done is I've taken vortex lines and magnetic field lines right around this point here and this point here. Those are the two points of the peak current off the edge there. Here is the current multiplied to the fourth power that emphasizes it, but the peak current has moved from the center out to these wings at this time. And so I'm looking at the vortex field, the magnetic field around that thing. So here you're seeing it's orthogonal, but it's actually starting to develop a more complicated structure, which we do not yet understand.
Maybe Norman's right. Maybe what you really look at is just a normal reconnection of vortex lines.
Well, I have a few graphs that you want to show your other video.
Yeah, first of all,
let's do that.
I have here visualizations of two different times of the ideal case compressive. And I'm showing here the current. As we looked at before.
What does the lower line mean in the color map?
Sorry, what do you mean?
There's a line in the color map.
This line is the box?
No, the color map.
No, the color map. It's the histogram of the distribution.
Oh,
of
I see.
Current.
Okay.
The current square. Now why don't we see the earlier time, one of the later time. So first of all, as we bring the, so here you see this current sheet again, the compressive calculation. This center surface. And here's this one here. So it's relatively small. If you lower the value, see that it's...
You're increasing the threshold.
I'm increasing the threshold, yeah. So it's only just a few points which show the peak current here.
By the way, Norm, you and Richard did two perpendicular dipoles. It should be locally...
Richard did that, yeah.
Yeah, and what is his finding there? That is a non-magnetic case.
Yeah, purely vortex. He actually did the Kiva initial condition.
Yeah.
And then he redid it with respect to looking for self-similar solutions with Biot-Savart. Mm-hmm. And he found Biot-Savart self-similar solution. That is, it just kept collapsing and collapsing and collapsing, yeah.
With the cross-vortex?
Two dipoles.
Okay, so
one dipole and multi-square, one dipole.
It's actually an octopole of dipoles.
It's actually 12. It's
bizarre.
You take every orthogonal axis and then you fire in two dipoles in that place. You have 12.
Right. I mean, the You need more wires. But there's another initial condition like that called Taylor Green, which I actually included in my introduction, but we decided I didn't have enough time really. But now we're.
Taylor Green is similar to Akita's vortex. It just starts with a few sine and cosines like this. This is the initial flow, just a simple anti-parallel shear. The Akita one is similar to this, but a little more complicated. And what happens in these types of things is you tend to start developing vortex sheets on symmetry planes. And then those vortex sheets, such as it evolves in time, come to this point here, where that is where the largest vorticity is. And just the way a current sheet is believed to suppress any tendency towards a singularity of ideal MHD, the formation of these vortex sheets in this problem suppresses any tendency towards a singularity. On top of that,
only if they're flat.
Only if they're flat. But I'm saying that's these current sheets, really flat. Okay. But on top of that, you notice that the ends of the current sheets are actually rolling up into individual vortices at this time here. But it isn't that simple. There's symmetry planes here. What you have here is you have a dipole of vortices here that's hitting across this boundary up here a orthogonal dipole like this. So they're coming together like this. And this is a simplified view of what happens with the quadruple, well, the 12th thing in the Akita one. And that tends to suppress singularities. But at the same time, what happens next is that the corners, those where those four are meeting, they start aligning into these orthogonal configurations. And if you go back to where I was at the beginning, where I showed, oh, I didn't show it. Where is it? Right. This is a recalculation I did of their one of their initial conditions. And you start with two good idea. You start with two orthogonal ones, and what happens is these arms are pulled off of the orthogonal ones, and as it evolves in time, the peak vorticity gets totally concentrated in those arms, which have become anti-parallel, and now you go into the whole scenario I started off with. So it's possible that you go from Taylor Green to sheets, that sheets roll up, they become orthogonal, and then they go anti-parallel, and then you could have a singularity. And that's probably what might happen after several steps in the Akita vortex also. And that might be what's happening in our MHD case. But we aren't here yet. Where we are is just beginning to get that, maybe. I mean, this goes back to my history thing. This is why people in 1983, the formation back in 1983 said, no, there were no singularities of oil because they were doing this smooth initial condition, and there's so many steps before it can get into a configuration where it might go singular that they just had no way of getting there. We still cannot run this long enough to be able to go through all those steps if my guess of what the steps is correct. So that tells you how far we have to go. That was 1983, it took 10 years before there was a calculation that looked reasonable, like it might have a singularity. We might not have a singularity, but if we do, it's going to take us hopefully less time than 10 years. But.
I have a question. You say you generate two vortex filaments per vortex or magnetic tube initially.
Right.
Did you check to see whether the Barrow Clinic term, since you have now a another kind of force in the momentum evolution equation is the thing that's doing it.
Well, that mine's in compressing.
In the, what you mean?
No, the thing is you can have it anyway. Barrow Clinic, it operates incompressibly. All you need is a
gradient.
appropriate gradient, right.
It's coming from the...
My conjecture is, or it shouldn't take very long to figure this out, but the magnetic tube is producing that kind of force, volume force, such that you're having baroclinic generation of vorticity of the opposite sign on the top, one sign on the top, another sign on the bottom. That's why it's counter-rotating, okay? And obviously it's some sort of gradient.
Actually, that's the interpretation that B.C. Low likes to prefer for explaining.
That's the important, yeah.
Yeah.
So then
yeah.
I would take it one step further and say, okay, if that is the case, then that important term, which is generating vorticity, there's a corresponding term for generating current sheet.
Right.
And the interaction of the two baroclinic terms, one for vortex generation, the other for current generation, are the essence of whether you're going to get a reconnection or a singularity. In other words, if you want to look at the possibility or even the numerical errors, you have to look at two sources, very carefully at two sources.
Isn't your theory at time two is already answering the first part of your question when one magnetic ring is splitting to, that's independent of their contact.
That's right.
It's
yes.
All uniform around.
It's just yes.
Yeah.
Right.
So that's yeah. Exactly what you think.
In other words, there's a certain symmetry which says it should happen one on the top.
If a single vortex ring
right.
Will also.
Magnetic ring.
Yeah. It's magnetic ring.
There are a whole bunch of other view graphs I could have presented, and they're somewhere in the stack here that aren't very well put together. That discuss the separate generation terms of the current squared and the vorticity squared. And one of the things I've learned from Boyler is that the production of vorticity squared integral blows up in a way that's similar to 1 over the peak vorticity.
Yes, yeah, sure.
Okay. And by analogy, and there's no math behind this except John Gibbon has some ideas that he's going to talk about with me and Axel later. There's no math behind it, but by analogy, all the similar production terms for the current should do the same thing for this if there's a singularity. And one of the signs that maybe we don't have a singularity is none of that stuff is behaving. Actually, what it's doing is it's growing far faster at this point than it should. It's not consistent. And to do a good analysis of that, we don't have the maybe my latest series of calculations, these 648 cube calculations that I just finished about 2 months ago. Maybe when I analyze those, I can get it. But you know how complicated those terms are there. I filled up an entire machine using all the processors to stuff in 648 cubed. And that's just with 12 variables, U, B, omega, and J. To calculate those other terms, I have to have the derivatives of everything. I have to have derivatives of current, the derivatives...
Yeah, but you really only need them locally. Most of the time, they're zero in the entire field.
Well, that's quite true.
You have to track these features.
But I have to... But before I know that, I have to know what it looks like over the whole field. And at this point, I mean, I could do this. I have to do a lot of swapping in and out of the machine and everything like this, but I haven't programmed that in to the particular machine I'm doing this on yet. So, it's something that can be done, but it's a lot of work, and we're not there yet.
Bob, to apply this to turbulent flows, would it make a difference if you filled the space that appears to be empty of flux in your initial conditions? If you filled that with field lines that were, say, penetrating the loops but not linked, that might, through if you had incompressibility, prevent the two loops from pulling against
the other. Well, exactly that's what will happen if you do that. If you put extra stuff in there, it will prevent this from happening. The reason for doing what the relationship of this to turbulence is, which is another lecture, is if you start off with a configuration like that, you're talking about this soup of magnetic field lines or a soup of vortex lines, and you let that evolve, what you find is, at least for the vortex one, since I've never done a full MHD turbulence simulation for the vortex ones, locally, every place where vortex lines are meeting, they want to go into this anti-parallel configuration and start reconnecting on the very smallest scales, smaller than whatever size of vortex you put in there. So if you start off with a soup, we're talking about the scale that's smaller than that. And at that scale, the bigger, all the soup is big.
But there's another very interesting problem from the point of view of MHD decay, that if you start off with a soup, it's the largest loop that's going to dominate the energy. You're going to tend to decay to a situation where you have one dominant or a few dominant loops at large scales. And then could they have this type of behavior to decay?
No.
The soup ones, at least in some low-level simulations we've done, we've never seen.
I know of one numerical 3D simulation which does see that. Jason Marone has some unpublished results in which he gets decay to
that situation is completely artificial. I mean, you cannot get things to link if they haven't been linked first.
It has to be
done some calculations that were never published, that if you take vortex rings that are skewed like this and shoot them each other,
they can
link.
That's a very contrived situation.
It's a very contrived situation.
It has to be.
But the relevance of this to the sun, which I didn't get to, the link thing, is because, okay, helicity is a topological invariant, and
in Invisid,
but it's equivalent to twisting up a line. So this is actually equivalent to wrapping these around each other. Okay? This, I haven't broken these. Therefore, I haven't reconnected. Topologically, this is the same, but now it's wrapped around each other. If you know about this corona, and you know about foot point motion, and you know about twisting up a foot point motion and arcades and all that stuff, the impetus is behind this is that you have twisted magnetic flux lines in the solar corona that look more like this and not like this, but I have a series of pictures here that can show you that those will actually evolve into something that looks more like this. Anyway, I think, let Axel show his last movie, and I think then we better call it quits for...
Mm-hmm. So here is, here are various animations that show the evolution of field lines. Here, for example, both rotating and time evolving here. Show both simultaneously.
Viewing is rotation, right? The vortices are there.
They're both evolving in time and they're rotating.
Yeah, so really close one of these.
What's the color probably?
There's altogether 16 different rings. There are 16 different rings, and each of them has a different color. I want to focus on this one here. And so this is the first time. Each of them has a different color, and they are located at the periphery of the rings, at approximately 80% of the diameter. And now as time goes on, these rings are invected, and of course these rings represent magnetic field lines because this is an ideal calculation. So within the numerical error, they are equivalent to field lines here in this calculation. As time goes on, you see that these rings, first of all, interchange because the outer parts remain behind and the inner parts pull inwards, and so that leads to this contraction here. And you see that in the middle, where the two rings actually come into contact, they begin to press against each other, and this makes the field lines essentially straight. So here you see the field lines are locally surprisingly straight, but they are at right angles to each other. So let's look at this again at high speed. So that's how these field lines bump into each other here. And this is all automatically driven. Self-induced, self-driven by the Lorentz force. There's no external force pushing them together. Simple fact, why this is actually leading to such a situation, why nature doesn't escape this, is simply because there is helicity. Helicity prevents the two rings from escaping each other, they have to stay linked for the whole time, and the Lorentz force is then pushing them together. So it's no escape, really. So all these are compressor calculations at a modest Mach number. If we make the sound speed much lower, then of course there is strong evidence that in the sun the sound speed is extremely low, then the entire process is much more rapid. So it may turn out that in the incompressible case, the growth is really exponential, but as we go to the compressible case, the growth is definitely speeding up. Possibly algebraically, but definitely faster than otherwise. I think that's
right, and that gets back to the question of what we really need is a fast dynamical mechanism to work in the corona. Whether it's singular or not, it might not be important. What's important is we've obviously discovered some new dynamical mechanism that's maybe an important step in that direction.
And should also mention that a similar growth of the current, like this 1 over T behavior, is not seen in a two-dimensional equivalent calculation.
Nothing like this.
Yeah, so if you have a straight tube going through a ring, and the ring is then contracting, you don't see anything like this 1 over T behavior. 1 over T minus T minus T behavior.
I think that one qualitative difference between two types of calculations are whether the curvature of the intersecting lines are positive towards each other or negative. Then, for example, in that configuration, you might just in a simple picture assume.
Well, as I said, this was so simple.
Right.
What we, you know, what it really is, you know, something like this.
Right.
And there's a model. I shouldn't go into models and models and models and models.
There's a model that can explain. Answer most of Fosley's questions about, I guess, just this bizarre configuration.
Just in general, though, perhaps the two of it are qualitatively different in some way.
Yeah.
Curvature is definitely important, but it's kind of irrelevant to the reconnection process. Just bring the two filaments together, and that's why you need the curvature.
But I guess the
self-induction.
But the actual interface. There's a point at which the radius of curvature, you know, radius of curvature, size of the radius of curvature compared to the scale of the interface.
See, I mean, Fosley was quite right. I mean, once I have a configuration like this, I must have had some reconnection already occurred. And the thing is that really happens is that you have this arcade of these linked things like this. I mean, loop things. And what that is, the whole thing's rising up. In some sense. And then it's pulling out something underneath it. And then that's where the reconnection is occurring.
But it's just that in this case, it's spontaneous because the Lorentz forces are pulling the thing together, you know, in this
but
direction.
There's large scale and small scale dynamics. So on the large scale, there's a Lorentz force depends on that curvature.
Right.
But on the small scale, smaller than the
curvature. I agree, that's probably similar.
There's a model by Tahar Amari that can sort of put this all in a solar physics perspective with arcade and twisted field light. If someone wants to explain it to me, this is what that, and then I can't. I mean, even a French friend will take me. Have you seen this calculation, Tahar?
No.
Okay, well, I should explain that to you. That's
what
always out of
the name?
Tahar.
Tahar.
We will spell it the way, we will say it the way you would say it in English. Remember, French isn't right either. That's his name.
Amari.
Yeah. He's at Saclay in France.
His name is Amari.
Yeah.
Remember?
Okay. Right. That's what he needs to remember.
Good talk. I thought
Yeah,
compressing is to
do
what I'm saying.
Makes sense.
Yeah, where does the
basically the only place to ask are
generated by the configuration. Is it just like by squeezing and generates little stuff?
No, I mean, the standard magnetic lines are by the students by the
Lorentz force.
Lorentz force we create will be
over in the inelastic approximation where
the only zero V is zero.
Magnetic lines.
Right. Once I need that, that's the only place where anything quasi is
there. Oh, well, it's
I actually understand that.
Whether or not you have
the inner parts faster than the outer parts.
What about the cross section? Yeah.
Why did the outside dimple in then? Because that shouldn't.
So this is a ring.
Right. More plasma pressure on the outside because there's more area than on the inside. That's BC's explanation for it.
More plasma pressure outside.
Right. Because there's more outside area.
I would say B squared is larger in the inner part than in the outer part. Therefore, these parts will go in faster than the outer part.
Ah, that's what you're saying.
Yeah, and then so it kind of cuts the ring.
But what about the outer? What about the very outer edge?
It's by continuity,
like so, of course.
The inner just circle dominates the back curvature.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah, good.
So this, and then you have these two bodies.
It's the dipole now.
No, it's a dipole.
Dipole.
A stronger way.
In the middle?
The curvature is stronger in the middle because the magnetic field is stronger.
Well, the magnetic field is stronger, yes. And so the Lorentz force is J cross B.
Right.
Larger. The dominant part, which is B dot B dot grad B.
Yeah.
Right? And that is that's the curvature force.
Okay.
The curvature is along the direction of the magnetic field, so if it's curved, you get a force that points inward.
Right.
But if it's in a clear way, it has to rotate. It could just go like inward.
So the thing that dimples in the outside is just continuity. It's just because it's got to keep pressure balance.
I mean, it is really like a mushroom that is like an explosion. If you have an explosion, you generate a bubble which rises.
Yeah.
It generates a mushroom. And this mushroom, again, it looks like the body is ring.
Yeah.
It is a ring.
I mean, the way I always look at it, you have two horses. If you want to see which direction they move, it's whatever is on the outside. Like that's like tires or something.
There's no gradient field outward, don't you still?
Well, this two rings, it's not so obvious. You know, you have mutual induction and self-induction. Now let's see. Self-induction will push it away. Mutual induction pulls the ring. So they are orthogonal. And obviously the mutual induction is higher. That's why they move the parts.
Yes.
So pictures of what you're supposed to. That's very interesting, right?
Actually, we were just discussing that even if there were no field gradients, just by moving this thing, even if it's just one field line,
it's collapsing.
So it's the same.
Oh, just one ring.
Just one ring.
Oh, yeah, it does that calculation.
Is that
but
nothing happens in the current. I mean, you know, you get the two things and it's like creeping.
Oh,
one ring. one ring will develop in North Carolina for liquid rings.
Well, that's in the shadows here.
That's a ring here, but it's like three people
are saying
nothing very
That's interesting.
There's more area.
What position is that?
Perspective on this.